This is former United States Senator Christopher Dodd, who was appointed chairman and chief executive officer of the Motion Picture Association of America. He has expressed the view that flying all night to come to our meeting is quite a challenge. He's been on the job for 22 whole days. As president of this organization, represents the motion picture, home video, and television industries around the world. Senator Dodd was in the Congress for 6 years and then in the Senate for 30. As represented Connecticut, he was elected as one of the youngest people ever elected to serve in the Congress from Connecticut. He has written much legislation during his time, either himself or with others, including subjects on health care, financial services, foreign policy, and election reform. Senator Dodd was responsible for the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was adopted in the wake of one of the first financial crises in American history. Also, the Family and Medical Leave Act. Senator Dodd is well acquainted with the subject of disability. His sister is a blind person and a very active blind person. And I have had the pleasure of hearing Senator Dodd in the past, and I can tell you one thing about him that is not in his biography, and that is that he tells good jokes. This group, Senator, is made up mostly of lawyers. You, however, having been in the Senate, can manage a whole room full of lawyers. Please welcome our good friend, Senator Christopher Dodd.
Nice introduction, thank you. Well, that's an auspicious and dangerous introduction, I say. Anyone who thinks they can handle a room full of lawyers ought to leave the room immediately, I think, along the way. Well, I'm truly honored to be with all of you today, and Mark, thank you very much, and again, for that generous, and the brevity of the introduction. I sometimes wonder that the introductions I'm going to receive are longer than my remarks are going to be. There's always a danger if the master of ceremonies or mistress of ceremonies starts out by saying, he was born. That's always an important fact to know your speaker was born, I guess, in all of these things. Mark may have heard me tell this story. My favorite, I think, story of a public figure, of someone, or a former public figure for that matter, being introduced to an audience was years and years ago at the Waldorf Astoria, black tie dinner, very formal gathering of people to celebrate the life of William Howard Taft. And the lawyers in the room will appreciate the Taft contribution. Taft, of course, was the only one of us in the history of our country that ever served as both President of the United States and Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and a remarkable figure in many, many ways, a towering figure, not in terms of his accomplishments, but also towering physically. Taft was a giant and a man. He was well over 6 foot six, I think, weighed some 300, 400 pounds. He had retired at this point, and the master of ceremonies at this dinner was a very colorful United States Senator from New York by the name of Chauncey Depew. Can't imagine that on a bumper sticker, but that was his name, Chauncey Depew. And show you how the world has changed since the 1920s. They talk about problems today of conflicts of interest in people in public life. Chauncey Depew was president of the New York Central Railroad and senator from New York. No conflict there, I'm sure, when it came to on those issues. But he thought of himself as a pretty good gadfly and comic, I guess. And he went on at some length as Taft was sitting there at this very distinguished audience and concludes the introduction of Taft by saying, "It now gives me a great deal of pleasure to present to you a man who is both pregnant with integrity and pregnant with courage. Well, of course, the crowd roared its approval, gave Taft a standing ovation. Taft slowly made his way to the podium, waited for the crowd to be reseated, the noise to subside, and then turned to the audience and he said, "If it is a girl, I shall call her integrity. If it is a boy, I shall call him courage. But if, as I suspect, it's nothing more than gas, I shall call it Chauncey Depew." Here. As a dinner speaker here, you can imagine going through all of that. Well, anyway, I'm delighted to be with you today. And again, this is a wonderful gathering. I'm going to share some brief comments with you. And the most important thing you're going to be doing is obviously with each other and talking about how to move forward and to advance the issues that have been such a hallmark of both organizations that are here and others who are part of today's effort. And those of you who are involved in the subject of civil rights and issues, obviously, let me just say to all of you in the room who have been involved, I thank you. As someone who sat in the Congress of the United States for 36 years, five terms in the United States Senate, I only served in the Judiciary Committee. I was in the House back in the 1970s, just after the Watergate issues. I was elected in 1974. In fact, Tom Harkin and I arrived the very same day to Congress and maintain a great friendship to this day. In the Senate, I was not on the Judiciary Committee, but deeply involved in the issues as they came before the Health, Education, Labor Committee, as it's now called, and as well as other committees that where these issues arise and are the subject of debate and discussion. So today, I thought I'd just share some thoughts about that with you to celebrate what you're doing, in a sense. I think it's remarkable and timely and important, and I gather others have shared a similar thought with you as well. So to Mark as well, the longtime president, obviously, of the National Federation of the Blind, I want to thank him for his introduction as well, but also, far more importantly, his years and years of dedication to the subject matter before us today. Mark, thank you immensely from all of us across the country. For the tremendous job that you do. You worked with me and our office over the years, and we were successful. Too often people don't realize what a difference it means to have organizations and people behind you that help you craft and shape and move the issues. And Mark was just an invaluable supporter in all of those years, through all of those efforts. As many of you may know, and Mark suggested this, my long-standing relationship with the Federation is both personal and professional, going back decades. And I've witnessed firsthand the truly life-transforming work of NFB that it does to this day and has done over the decades. I also want to thank the American Association of People with Disabilities for hosting the event today as well. I've been equally honored to partner with them over the years and can attest that there's no stronger voice on behalf of individuals than AAPD. And I particularly want to thank the Senior Director for Corporate Social Responsibility, Robin Schaffert, and David Hale as well for the tremendous work they do as the Senior Director of Development and Communications. And I'd be remiss, I hope that she's still here, Maura Healey, who is the Assistant Attorney General for the state of Massachusetts. Is Maura still here? Was she? I know she was supposed to be here. Well, anyway, I thank her for her work as well on the subject matter. As all of you in this room know well, that blind and other people with disabilities have been able to gain such a substantial measure of participation in American life is largely due to the thoughts and pioneering efforts of Dr. Jacobus ten Broeck. Through his tireless work, individuals with disabilities have made great strides in realizing equal opportunity to participate fully in our society. So it is indeed fitting that we gather here today under the auspices of Dr. ten Broeck's lifelong efforts, not only to honor his tremendous work, but more importantly, in my view, as he would say if he were standing here, but to continue and to move forward, to receive greater gains, greater recognitions, and a greater acceptance under the civil rights laws of our nation. Throughout the time that I had the honor of serving the people of Connecticut, the Congress, no issue was as important to me or my work than to ensure that those most in need in our nation receive the opportunity to achieve both their full potential and the full participation in our society. Mark has already mentioned my sister Carolyn, but I always think it's instructive, and I shared these thoughts with my colleagues over the years. My sister Carolyn was born in the 1930s with cataracts. And today, something that would be, I suppose, in modern technology medicine would be not pose the kind of issues it did decades ago. And so she grew up as blind, or at least legally blind, and we'd say in those days. But my parents, and there was very little of opportunity, but my mother and father were remarkable people, and they had resources and things to make a difference. And so those New York Times books and machinery that filled our house as a child growing up, to watch my sister go through school, achieving the success she did, holding two master's degrees, reviving the American Montessori system of teaching in the United States at the Whitby School in Greenwich with Nancy Rambusch, and then running schools, teaching them in California, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., entering public education as an early childhood development specialist for 20 years, and retiring after 41 years of teaching. This was a person who affected the lives of thousands and thousands of people. There's hardly a day goes by when some child, not child now, an adult walks up and tells me a story about how they had my sister Carolyn as a teacher and what a difference she made in their lives as a young student starting out in their educational journeys. And so an example, obviously, had it not been for my parents having some resources to make a difference, but more importantly, a commitment that my mother and father had that this bright young woman was not going to be deprived the opportunity to achieve her full potential and to make a difference not only in her life, but in the lives of so many others. What a different world it would have been for a lot of those children had they not had Mary Carolyn Dodd as a teacher. And so the example, in many ways, is exactly what we're trying to succeed with in these efforts, to make sure that every generation of every Mary Carolyn Dodd have the opportunity to not only achieve their potential, but to make the contributions that all of us can benefit from and enjoy as human beings. So in my first days in Congress in the 1975, when I discovered that you could not be a Foreign Service officer in the State Department if you were blind, was my first act as a member of Congress to get a hold of Henry Kissinger and others in those days. And to say, what are you thinking of, possibly? The whole idea, again, we've suffered from over the years is that people can't imagine. It's not that they're cruel or vicious or mean-spirited. They just don't understand, in a sense, the capabilities and potentials and so many different areas. Obviously, the one we're talking about today, but nonetheless in all areas. And so that would not have happened had it not been that I was blessed as a child growing up in a large family with a sibling that had demonstrated over and over again the importance of all of that. And I'm, over the years, and again with Mark and so many others, working on those issues, the 504 efforts going back in the 70s, obviously, that were tremendously important. I was proud to be, I think, one of the first, if not the first, one of the first co-sponsors in 1989 of Tom Harkin's the Americans with Disability Act. And to this day, I wear it as a great source of pride. And how, as I said at our table over lunch, I miss my colleagues in the Congress. I don't miss being in the Congress, I got to tell you. A week ago Friday night, I was in bed at 9 o'clock, and I slept so soundly knowing that 7 blocks away, they were up till 2 in the morning. And I remember those nights very vividly. Now, they're not pleasant nights, being up that late, but let me just say, he's not here, but what a gift the state of Iowa has given to this country and to the world, and my colleague and friend Tom Harkin of Iowa. Just been a remarkable, remarkable individual. John, please tell him I thank him. And I served with Lowell Weicker from Connecticut, who was involved in those days, as so many others were, to be a part of those efforts, to see the passage of that legislation and to see the difference it made. Mark mentioned HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, after the 2000 election, with that highly contested election. And I insisted through all of those negotiations that while I kept on making the point that the right to vote is the right upon which all of the rights depend, in my view. I mean, it's always hard to single one thing out. But if you don't have the right to vote and the right to vote independently, then every other right that we have to achieve through our democratic processes is at risk. And so I must have said that line a million times as I tried to build support for a meaningful election law reform in the wake of what had happened, not because of results and who won and lost, but when you began to look at the error rates and the inability of millions of our fellow citizens to participate independently in the voting process. Again, one of those issues affected as a child. When I watched, I have to watch my sister, this highly intelligent, gifted, knowledgeable person, show up on a polling place in my state of Connecticut and have to have someone go in with her to cast her ballot was infuriating to me. And here it was, here we are, well into the, through the 20th century, beginning the 21st century, and we haven't figured out something we all crow about as Americans, this ability to have democratic, free elections with participation in everyone, which is a myth for millions of Americans, particularly those with sighting disabilities, to participate fully, that opportunity to make those choices independently. So while the law does a lot of good things, one of the best things it does is to see to it that we made voting accessible to every single American, and to do so independently in that law. And we have to monitor that, by the way. Regulations are being developed still, states and counties, because so much of this is run at the local level. And so while there's a federal law now, and we provided provisions in there, not as strong as I would have liked. I had an awful battle getting this done here. To bring actually actions under the civil rights laws in that legislation are limited. I fought as hard as I could. I got some, but it needs to be expanded. And I hope at some point, maybe in your discussions in the symposium, you'll examine, if not today, and looking at that law and how we can expand the opportunity to bring rights of action when people are denied. Because again, so much of it, going back to the founding of the Republic, election laws are totally dependent upon which county you live in and which state you're in terms of whether or not they're as open and as accessible as they ought to be in our country. John Lewis, a great friend, called that bill one of the great civil rights acts. And it is because not just about election laws, not enough people know about the accessibility, independent voting provisions of it as well. I'm proud to have also authored the Instructional Materials Accessibility Act. And again, these all come back to stories. And I hope in your discussion, the symposium today, the educational process, we never lose sight of the ability to tell stories. You know, that there's nothing that galvanizes the attention of an audience more of saying, let me tell you a story about someone. Too often, I think we get into this business and we talk in numbers and statistics, and the audience we're seeking to motivate, to activate, you can lose pretty quickly. But like any other event historically, people have known about the Holocaust, obviously, for decades now. But the Diary of Anne Frank captured the attention, obviously, of the world because of the story of a child. Roots, again, how many of us heard about documentaries and read histories of, obviously, the great tragedies of slavery in our country? And yet it was Alex Haley's Roots, which for all of a sudden, for millions of people, brought the story home in a graphic way that they could understand. And so I always think it's important, as we talk about and debate these issues, that we remind people of stories of individuals. The story of the accessibility materials, educational materials, very simple. I asked a child in Connecticut to come down and testify before the Senate one day. I had never met her before. I just wanted some child to come from a school. And this young lady showed up and blew the entire Senate away. a blind child from Guilford, I think, Connecticut she was. And told a story, and here she was, a 4.0 student, all A's and everything else, how she had to wait to get materials in Braille because they weren't printed simultaneously with the text that other children were getting. And as a result of that, her testimony, that's which I had never heard of before. I didn't know about it. My sister obviously was out of school at this point in the 1980s, 1990s. That as a result, we drafted the legislation, passed the legislation. Today, blind children get accessible Braille materials exactly at the same time as a seeing child does because of that legislation. And we're moving it up into higher education areas as well. Again, it may not sound like a big deal to others, but for a child out there trying to learn. The Civil Rights Restoration Act, Non-Discrimination Act, Emmett Till legislation. Again, this is why this debate can be important. I drafted the legislation called the Emmett Till Unsolved Civil Rights Crimes Act. I don't know how many of you saw 60 Minutes a week or so ago or watched it or listened to it, but there is a case where an individual who was shot and killed, African-American, back in the 1960s, and it was a cold case. And yet because of this office now within the Justice Department, go back and proceed, and even though it's getting harder and harder, obviously, with the passage of time, the ability to actually find people and get new testimony to go after those. None of us ever want anyone to have a sleep-filled night that may have involved in some of the worst crimes in the 20th century. To know that somehow no one's ever going to bother them again. So the Emmett Till legislation may not solve every possible civil rights crime that went on in those days, but those who are out there ought to know that we're never going to stop trying with that. And again, it's an example of what you're going to be talking about here today, and that is how do we bring these communities together in a way and stop the separation as if there were sort of two constitutions, two sets of books on civil rights here. Keeping it separate, I think, has been one of the things we need to get over. I know that's going to be the major theme in conversation you're going to have. And while I'm no longer in the halls of Congress to cast a vote and a ballot on these issues, as I've told Mark, count me in. I mean, I'm still involved, and I'm now a mogul in the TV or movie business. I became a 20 days on the job, and I'm a mogul for a while. get the job done. So I hope you'll include me in the mental health parity legislation again. The years Ted Kennedy battled on that, his son Patrick. I ended up floor managing that bill. Joe Biden was terrific on the issue. The day that the TARP legislation passed was the day I managed on the floor of the Senate the mental health parity bill as well. And the great tragedy it was, all the news was about the TARP bill, obviously, with the financial problems of the country. And here was a day that people had fought for years and years and years within the civil rights community to treat mental illness on a parity with physical illnesses. And it got lost in all the news that day, passed the United States Senate. A classic example, again, where there needs to be a sense of unity about these issues. Mental illness, it does not have some sort of a stovepipe where you may be blind, but you're never going to have a mental illness issue. Or you have a mental illness issue, you may not be blind. All these things come together seamlessly in a civil rights debate and discussion. And so that sense of unity, whether you're talking about Emmett Till, you're talking about mental health parity, you're talking about sexual orientation, you go down the long list, and the civil rights issues come together seamlessly. And again, the idea that there's been sort of this separation has made it much more difficult. And I think we would have been even more successful over the years had we found that sense of unity earlier. That's not to suggest we haven't been successful. I think we've done a lot of good things, but a lot more needs to be done. And your symposium today will, I think, help you get closer to that. Anyway, as chairman of the Subcommittee on Children and Families, I spent a lot of time on these issues. I mentioned the case of the Education Materials Accessibility Act, again, and early in the process. So there have been great successes and strides towards achieving Dr. Tenbrook's goal of full participation in our society. For indeed, with the critically valuable support that we've already realized enormous progress in this country, from the original, as I mentioned earlier, the Disabilities Act, to the Help America Vote Act. And throughout these battles, and they were battles, believe me, the tendency, people look back, and I wish we had better memories on all of this, because once they're done, it sounds like it must have just sort of happened this way, and particularly with younger people, to know how hard people had to fight. And maybe it's maybe the fact that we don't have such great memories, maybe it's a blessing in some ways, I guess, because people move on. But today, no one would suggest about undoing the Americans with Disability Act. But for those of you with a few gray hairs in this room, as I look around, some with no hair at all, these were incredible battles to get through. I did an interview the other night with a child from Utah. She called someone I knew, and she's the debate champion in her town of Logan, Utah. And she wanted to talk to me to prepare for her debate on the Americans with Disability Act. She's 9 years old, in a wheelchair in that community. And she kept me on the phone for an hour with tremendous questions about the history and what happened and why did people fight against this and what was their arguments and so forth. And it went back and caused me to reach back myself, having been involved, not to the extent that Tom was and Lowell Weicker and others, but it's only one of the foot soldiers in it. And I had to go back and review how big a battle was that? How long did it take us and after 89 to get this done? And it is important, and I hope in the process, those of you who are older, those of you who may be teachers or involved in the educational systems, wherever you're from, make it part of that story. People need to know how hard these battles were to achieve these results. One, because it can motivate people during difficult times to achieve the kind of successes we're looking for. So, again, I don't need to remind anyone in this room about that and how difficult they were. And it's been, as I said, an honor to have been involved and proud as long as I live. I have two very young children. I'm a late bloomer in the father business. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old children. I decided to have my own grandchildren. Along the way. I sort of missed that piece along the way. So I'm running around a lot, I'll tell you that. Actually, the red eye wasn't bad, considering the alternative where I could have been. But I want my two daughters. My 9-year-old has very, very severe life-threatening food allergies. And just an experience of in schools and trying to educate people about life-threatening with the EpiPens and all the things. She's been an anaphylaxis 4 or 5 times. And educating people about what has to be done and how it's not threatening and it can be done simply and easily. But it's incredible to me the ignorance people can have about the simplest of things. And not to suggest that this is terribly overbearing. It's not at all. But it's stunning to me. I remember a woman on a plane, we're sitting with Grace, and we have to wipe down the seats and do everything because it's airborne allergies as well. She can pick up and go on anaphylaxis. And the stewardesses were very helpful, the flight attendants, and they said, we have a child with us, and we'd appreciate if people would not eat nuts and peanuts. And she's got about 6 other allergies. And the woman sitting behind us, I was getting the seats all wiped out, I looked over, and she had some big peanut candy bar she was eating. And I said, I apologize, maybe you didn't hear, but my child is sitting in front of you, has these, oh, what's she going to do, break into a little rash? She said, you know, she was furious over this. And so even something as simple is this, the educational process takes so darn long to convince people how important some of these issues are. Anyway, efforts, and again, there's so much to talk to you about, and I don't know how you're going to get all of this in your symposium, but having been deeply involved in the inappropriate and deadly use of restraints, it was something I championed for a long time. Again, a story in my state, Portland, Connecticut. A young child was restrained in a mental health facility and died because of the failure of training and the ability to understand what the child was going through. And this 11-year-old boy lost his life as a result of it, and provoked the legislation and the efforts over the years to deal with legislation on the deadly use of restraints and seclusion in mental health institutions, ensuring that those that were struggling with disabilities receive the critically needed support that they have a right to, regardless of whether those supports are needed in the classroom, in the voting booth, in a health facility, wherever it may be. And I've been honored throughout the years of my public service to have the support of the nation's disability community in these efforts. And again, many of you in this room, Mark specifically, and obviously the association, have played such an important role in making it possible for us to have the successes we've had. That's not to say, obviously, that we're out of the woods, and you wouldn't be gathered here today if we thought we were. Today, as we all know, we still face many, many challenges, and that is why we can never slow our work to ensure our ultimate goal, and that is the work of each of you, the full inclusion of all individuals with disabilities in our wonderful society we call America. Hubert Humphrey, and I'm sure all of you have heard those lines, I've used them so many times over the years, when he talked about the moral test of any government in any nation anywhere, and that is to treat those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the aged, and those in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped, as he said it in those days, going back decades ago, to quote him exactly. And as we know, the so-called, quote, shadows, as famously referred to by Hubert Humphrey, need not only be due to a disability or perceived disability. In fact, as we all know, far too many Americans throughout our history were relegated to the shadows of our society solely due to their gender, the color of their skin, their sexual orientation, or a disability. In that respect, both the civil and disability rights movements are truly one and the same, truly one and the same. And for their core, both the disability rights movement and the civil rights movement share as their ultimate goal the equal treatment under the law of all people, regardless of whether the source of that unequal treatment is an inability to see, the need of a wheelchair, one's gender, the color of one's skin, or their sexual orientation. No matter the source of prejudice, the disability rights and the civil rights movements fight the same battles every single day and reach for the same goals and seek protection under the same Constitution of the United States. For the disability rights and civil rights communities, it's time that we come together and act as one. And that is why this symposium is so important and why my sister insisted I be here, and Mark threatened my life if I didn't come here today. But seriously, to come, because I think it's so important what you can do. This is an historic meeting. I use those words carefully. Not every meeting is historic. This is historic, of coming together to figure how we fashion this unified effort to make a difference in the lives of people. The abilities, the talents, and so forth of betting through so many battles together, now joining forces in a way to achieve those same kinds of results. As we all know, for far too long, our struggles to achieve equality of opportunity for individuals with disabilities has been held separate from the struggle to achieve civil rights for those without disabilities. And today, begin that conversation to end that separation. For if we are ever to achieve fully the goal that was the life work of Dr. Tenbrook, namely the full and absolute inclusion of all Americans in our society, then there's no room for separation between the disability and civil rights communities. And today we begin that path toward the bridging the gap between those communities. And today we speak with one voice. And I am proud to add my voice to that clarion call for unity. And as I said earlier, why I no longer sit in the halls of Congress, I want to be available in any way I can to continue the efforts and join with you in that cause to see to it that we achieve that full participation of all of our citizens. We've never achieved the more perfect union that our founders have talked about over the years. But each generation, we're getting a little better at this. We have setbacks from time to time. But each generation bears the responsibility to get us closer to those goals. And I think the generation before us, in a sense, the generation that served in these last 30 years or so, the Tom Harkins of the world and others, I think can be proudly identified as having achieved a tremendous amount. Now, each generation needs to move that ball forward, in a sense. And that's why you're gathered here today, to figure out how to do that, and then to call upon those in elective office and private life across the spectrum to participate in that. There's an old Irish expression, you know, it says there's no luggage rack on a hearse, in a sense. And in a way, yeah, think about that for a minute, if you will. You've got that in a sense. And so when you're, towards the end of our days, and your children and grandchildren look back and say, what did you do with your life? No one really wants to say, well, I worked every day or whatever else. We like to think we've made a contribution. In our watch, in our time, in our own way, only a handful ever get to be a congressman or a senator or head up a major organization like this. But each one of us has an opportunity to answer that question, whether we're ever asked it or not. And I think as we go through our lives, reminding ourselves of that question periodically is worthwhile. And you're doing so by being here today, being a part of this symposium, asking and answering that question of what can I do on my watch, in my time, to make a difference in the lives of others. And as Americans coming together to achieve the goals laid out so many decades ago, we're on the path of achieving that. And I can't thank you enough for inviting me to be part of your discussion today. Thank you all very, very much. Yeah. Mark, thanks very much. Yeah. Yeah.
The Senator, in 2009, it came to be the 200th anniversary of the birth of Louis Braille. You were in the Senate in 2007. When we inquired if you could ask that the Mint strike a coin bearing Braille symbols, which would be the first coin ever struck by the United States Mint with full-size readable Braille, that bill passed, the coin was struck, you have helped the symbolism of including disabled Americans be represented by a genuine American silver dollar. And unlike some U.S. coins, this one is actually silver. Here is one for you, Senator.
Mark, thank you very much. Thanks, everybody. And Mark, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's more than just having a coin, which is huge battles, by the way. There are more suggestions of coins every year in Congress, so you only get to do two a year, all we ever tolerate. So winning the battle of getting the coin. But the money from this that we're raising is to actually support the educational efforts, because I was stunned to learn what a tiny fraction of the blind population can actually read Braille. And, of course, the highest unemployment rates are some of the highest in the disability community among those who are blind. The ability to read is so critically important. So the resources from this, aside from recognizing Louis Braille and having a nice coin, is actually putting resources together to make a contribution to increase the level of competency in Braille itself. So I'm deeply proud to have been a part of that as well. I thank you, my dear friend.
Yeah, thank you.
Good to be with you.
Mark. Yes, you're right about that, Senator. $2,217,000 have gone into the programs of Braille literacy work of the National Federation of the Blind. We are matching that with an additional $2,217,000, and consequently, Braille literacy will increase in the United States. We appreciate your coming. Now, I said to the senator a bit ago, and he said, "You can count on that." I said, "You know, we know that you represent, you're moguling around now. We know you represent this industry, and we would like to have disability be represented in a great way in the movie industry." And he said, "You know, you can count on that. I'm looking forward to all of that moguling you're going to be doing, Senator. Thank you very much for being with us." We have another person. This is Andy Imperato. He is now senior counsel and disability policy director for the United States Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, chaired by Tom Harkin of Iowa. I would give you the rest of his introduction, but it would take some of his time. Andy Imperato has been the executive of the American Association of People with Disabilities. And one of the reasons that this conference is as well known and as successful as it is that Andy Imperato wanted to promote joint work in programs dealing with disability among entities representing disabled people. And he wanted to have disabled people be a greater part of that work than ever before in history. He asked that we have joint sponsorship of this symposium, which we were pleased to be able to do. It is a pleasure to welcome here our friend, Andy Imperato.
Thank you very much. I'm not a senator, and I'm going to be brief. I really appreciate the opportunity. I've been at each one of these conferences, and it's been fun to watch them grow each year and to see the caliber of the speakers that we've had every year. And really, that is a tribute to everybody at NFB, everybody on the steering committee, but particularly Lou Anne Blake, who works very tirelessly to make this happen. You know, I want to say I'm on my second tour with Senator Harkin. I worked for him in 93, 94, and then after going to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the National Council on Disability and then AAPD for 11 years, I came back at the end of November. And it's been a great reminder for me of what an extraordinary leader we have in the United States Senate in two very important roles. He's chairing the committee that Senator Kennedy chaired for so many years, the Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, which is the lead committee on education policy, the lead committee on much of civil rights policy, particularly for people with disabilities, the lead committee on a lot of health policy, labor and employment issues. And Senator Harkin is constantly asking whether he's working on the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, the Workforce Investment Act, the Higher Education Act, healthcare reform, constantly asking, how is this going to work for people with disabilities? How's it going to work for children? How's it going to work for adults? What can we do to make sure that people with disabilities are having their needs addressed as part of this legislation? And to me, the chance to be back there with him as he's chairing this committee, surrounded by staff who know how committed he is to these issues, is a real once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. He's also the chair of the Appropriations Subcommittee that funds labor, health and human services, Social Security, and education. So he has a somewhat unique role in the Senate to be able to pass legislation and then make sure that funding the legislation is a priority. I'm going to be brief. I'm working on a number of things for Senator Harkin, but I want to pick up on the theme that Commissioner Feldblum struck this morning around the kind of the unique opportunities we have around employment and increasing employment for people with disabilities. Senator Harkin spoke earlier this week to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he focused on some data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that has not gotten a lot of attention from policymakers. We now get monthly reports on the employment situation for people with disabilities. That was a long fight that Senator Harkin was part of, Tony Coelho was part of, decades-long fight. 2008, the Bureau of Labor Statistics started collecting monthly data on disability employment rates, and in January of 2010, they started reporting the disability data. And a lot of people have looked at the unemployment number for people with disabilities, but from our perspective, that's not that significant of a number because that only represents people who are actively looking for a job, and most people with disabilities who are not working are not actively looking for a job, so we don't show up in the unemployment rate. So the number that we focus on is the labor force participation numbers, which is the number of people with disabilities who are working or are actively looking for a job. And that number in March of this year was 4.9 million, which represented about 32% of the working age population with disabilities. We thought it was interesting to look at how that number had changed in the time that we've been collecting it. And there's seasonal differences, so we wanted to compare it to the same month in prior years. So if you look at that March of 2011 number and compare it to March of 2009, which is as far back as we go, that number has gone down by 395,000 workers. In March of 2009, there were 5.3 million people with disabilities in the labor force. And in March of this year, that number was 4.9 million. So then we looked at, well, how does that compare with what was happening in the labor force overall? The number for the labor force overall was a much higher number in March of 2009. It was 141.9 million, and it dropped by about a million to 140.9 million in March of this year. So two interesting things that come out of that from us. One is more than one in three of the people who have left the labor force in the last 2 years were people with disabilities. So in terms of the disproportionate impact that the recession has had on people with disabilities, that's a pretty striking number. The other interesting thing is if you look at it as a percentage, going down from 5.3 million to 4.9 million was about a 7.5% reduction in employment for people with disabilities. Going down from 141.9 million to 140.9 million was about a 0.7% reduction for the general population. So the rate at which people with disabilities are leaving the labor force is more than 10 times the rate for the general public. So Senator Harkin was in front of a business audience and he said two things. We need to stop this trend. We just celebrated the 20th anniversary of the ADA. We can do better than this. And as a business community, I need you to do what the president did last year, which is start setting some public goals and benchmarking against those goals so you know you actually know what you're doing in this area. And he pointed to Walgreens. Walgreens set a public goal that 20% of their distribution center workforce would be workers with disabilities. They set a goal of 10%, and then when they were close to hitting that, they increased it to 20%. CSC set a public goal around hiring people with disabilities 2 years ago, and last year, 11% of their hires in the U.S. were people with disabilities. And they actually track that, and they report out on it. And I think a lot of lawyers that work for companies are telling them, you can't set goals in this area, you can't ask people if they have a disability, you're opening yourself up to liability. And there's leadership in the business community that has said, no, we don't care. Everything that matters to us, we measure. This is something that matters to us, and we're going to start measuring it. And that was Senator Harkin's message to the business community earlier this week. I want you to set a goal. President Obama signed an executive order last year calling on the federal government to hire 100,000 new workers with disabilities over the between now and 2015. So picking up on that, Senator Harkin said, let's try to get that 4.9 million number up to 6 million by 2015. That would be a 20% increase. If the federal government does its part, that gets you 100,000 right there, and then we would need to add another million. If you look at the federal government as a percentage of the workforce, the federal government is about 1.8% of the workforce. So if they can hire 100,000 people, we should be able to get the other million from the rest of the country. Interestingly, state and local governments are over 13% of the workforce. So one of the things that I see as an opportunity is getting the public sector more broadly to follow the lead of President Obama and set some goals for public hiring, state of Maryland, Baltimore City, and around the country. From Senator Harkin's perspective, there's nothing more important to him right now than increasing the employment rates for people with disabilities. He's very frustrated that the numbers haven't increased in a measurable way since the ADA was passed, and he was particularly frustrated that they've been getting worse and so disproportionately worse in the last 2 years. So what I wanted to say to you is we really invite the opportunity to work with the National Federation of the Blind, with AAPD, with all of the groups represented in the room to really get serious about moving those employment numbers up and to get serious about understanding what are all the factors that are leading people to leave the workforce. One of the things that Senator Harkin pointed to is what this means for Social Security disability applications. In January of 2008, the Social Security Administration was getting about 200,000 applications a month for SSDI. At the end of last year, that number was up to close to 250,000. Big increase. Again, it's not a surprise for people that are used to looking at when there's an economic downturn, there's more applications for benefits. But there's a lot of money involved in this, and we're having a discussion as a country about the future of our entitlement programs. I think there's an effort to kind of circle the wagons and protect the entitlement programs that we have, and that's important, as Wade Henderson talked about. But there's an opportunity to say, if we can do a better job around disability employment and make sure people have the kinds of jobs that are going to be clearly more attractive than being on disability benefits, then that's going to have a very positive impact on the economy overall. This is a great opportunity working with Senator Harkin. The ranking member of our committee, Senator Enzi, is also committed to increasing employment opportunities for people with disabilities. We're working with him right now to try to create alternatives for young people with intellectual disabilities so that they're not tracked into sheltered employment or sub-minimum wage jobs. We appreciate the leadership of the National Federation of the Blind on that issue. I'm really here to say I'm in a new role, but I'm still part of this community. I'm still trying to do everything I can to advance the goals of the ADA. And now I'm doing it with an incredible partner in Senator Harkin, who's very committed and is in a great position in the Senate to do this. But we can't do it without your support. It's obviously a difficult political environment. The House is a very different place than the Senate. And I think part of our job over the next 2 years is to educate our members of Congress. Take what you learned from this conference, take your agenda coming out of this conference, and take the time to sit down with my counterparts in your senators who represent you, your House members, and explain to them what are the civil rights issues for people with disabilities 21 years into ADA? What are the civil rights issues for children with disabilities, 35 years into IDEA? And what can we do as a country to set goals around high school graduation rates with regular high school diplomas, set goals around poverty rates? More than a quarter of people with disabilities are living in poverty based on the most recent number from the Census Bureau. There's a lot of numbers that just are not where they need to be. And I think in our role in the HELP Committee, we're trying to set some goals, build bipartisan support for those goals, get the business community behind it, but probably more importantly, get the disability advocacy community behind it so that we can all be pushing in the same direction. I know that we're running up against the workshops. If there's time for questions, I'm happy to take a couple, but I'm also happy to just stick around and do it informally if that works better. Thank you all for having me here.
How would you feel about taking up with the next section in 10 minutes or so and making an effort to find a few minutes for Andy to answer questions late this afternoon? Very well. So can we gather in the meeting room in 10 minutes? Very good. Thanks, Andy.